It's Friday, October 31st. Happy Halloween. You're watching Endpoint TV.
Welcome back to Endpoint TV. This is your host, Ron Jacobs, and I'm delighted to be here with Scott. And Scott, tell us about yourself.
So I'm an enterprise solution strategist with Advaya, and I kind of focus on the Microsoft platform in general, but specifically more on data and SOA and how do you use this to make sense of all the different offerings that Microsoft has.
So a strategist, you're kind of like one of these people when the big guys go, what is Microsoft up to? Get this guy in here and explain it to us. So you're that guy?
Yeah, maybe not so much. More of a rationalizing how does everything fit together and how can I take advantage of all of the, because Microsoft has lots of really good products and the real strength is in combining them, getting them to work together. It's more of how do you get them to work together efficiently and for larger organizations who have purchased a lot of these different products, how do I make sure I'm getting it the most out of what I've already purchased?
And surprisingly, that's not always as straightforward as it should be.
No. And there's all sorts of political and internal reasons. And a lot of it, too, is you look at some of the different features that maybe don't get as much press and that they're bundled in with the product and people just don't know that they've got it. And so some of that is just an education. Yeah. Hey, you've already bought this. It's there. Why don't you go ahead and use it and it will solve this specific problem?
Well, and it's I've heard people say that Microsoft sometimes functions more like, 50 little companies that are kind of loosely organized, and so very often, you'll talk to somebody over here and they say one thing and then somebody over here says something different, and it's just because they don't know about the other guy, kind of thing.
Well, like any large organization, you're going to have people who are brilliant, they have good ideas, and they just start running with them, and they don't realize that they're kind of on parallel tracks. And so there's some of that, too, where you have things that appear to be competing or solving the same problem, and how do we get those to work together? How do we make sure that if I'm using a particular feature from this team, and then another team comes out with something that's very similar, do I continue using this one? Do I go with the other one? And kind of what's the supportability? What's going to be the story down the road?
Some
of it is crystal ball.
And we rely on natural selection to weed out the weak ones,
Exactly.
So, it's kind of funny because, from the outside, you might imagine there's some big group here that controls the destiny and shapes everything. It's not very often that is not the case. They sort of just watch what's growing up organically, and hey, that one looks pretty good, and that one looks similar. Well, let's see who wins, and they kind of let them fight it out.
And a lot of that through beta and CTP. Generally, by the time products release, there's at least some guidance from Microsoft that says, yes, they work together, or no, they don't, and this is why you want to use one over the other.
Yeah.
And that's part of the job, too, is just being aware of that.
Yeah, or very often it's like, here's two things you would expect would work together. They don't in this version, but the next one,
they will. Yeah,
that was sort of the case with Workflow and WCF, right?
Yes.
When they first came out, Workflow didn't support WCF, and they came out together, right?
Yeah, but, and you have those things all the time where you just go, what were they thinking? But when you get into it, there were some really good reasons, like they needed to ship sometime, and you can't have everything in version one.
Well, in fact, we see a little bit of this in what's going on with these waves of .NET 4 and Oslo and all this kind of stuff. So we've been talking about that this week. It seems like when you look at WF and WCF and .NET 4, you might say, why are they doing all this declarative business, right?
Right.
Did you have that reaction?
Yeah, I did. Going back even previous to that, I had seen some stuff about, we need to do workflow completely declaratively. And my first reaction then was, why?
Mm-hmm.
You've got great tools. Why do you need, why do you want to drop into XAMLPad or to some text editor and do everything declaratively?
Yeah.
And when I understood what Microsoft is doing with the modeling and being able to store it all in a repository and get the reuse out of it that way, it suddenly made sense. The light bulb came on.
Yeah.
If I've got this code, this DLL binary object there, the reuse is maybe not as great as if it's all declarative and I can kind of pull it apart and store individual pieces as their smaller components so that we can reuse the individual pieces. Kind of the vision that Ray Ozzie put out at Mix of developers needing to learn to do smaller pieces.
Yeah.
I think this is going to be a more natural thing than telling people to just start doing really small pieces. If I can take these pieces that I'm used to doing and have some way of decomposing them and reusing smaller bits, or at least discovering them. Mm-hmm. That's another problem too, that a lot of times people have written things that are perfectly reusable, but just like in Microsoft, in any organization, there's not a lot of communication. Someone ends up reinventing the wheel, and now I've got two competing things. I don't know how many times I've gone in and seen different departments or different groups, all of them writing an employee object or a customer object or something like that.
Well, you know, so this is an interesting thought. When you get into this at the enterprise scope, I mean, everybody wants to do the right thing, right? We want to, you know, reuse things and so forth. But we found historically that let's go create a framework. We're going to create this great framework, and everybody's going to plug into this framework. And that lasts, you know, maybe a year, 2 years, and then everybody goes, we hate that framework, and we got this better framework. And, you know, and so we're constantly turning around things like that. It just seemed to me that here we have a framework that's sort of two parts, reuse at the SOA level, which has pretty well been established and proven. Here's a service, reuse it. And then there's kind of reuse at the workflow activity level as a framework for kind of stitching together things. Do you think that's going to work?
I think it's going to work to the extent that people are incented to feed it at first. And there's been lots of different things like a knowledge management system. But it's only as good as the knowledge that's in there. So the first time you search for something, you get zero hits.
Right.
And if you immediately say, oh, this is junk and I'm not going to use it, it never gets better.
Yeah.
So I think the concept is solid. The execution is where it will have success or failure. And unfortunately, that's kind of one of those things that it will probably be an enterprise by enterprise or even department by department kind of adoption, where if my department, we say, well, we know this is a long road, we're in it for the long haul, we're going to put stuff in there, then I can start reusing those, discovering them, building things quicker, easier. If I give up on it after a little bit because there's nothing in it, then it's going to be a failure. But I think the vision is a sound vision.
So the vision begins with kind of this first enabling of .NET for this very declarative world. And then we layer on top of that then Oslo, the model, the tool, the language, or repository tool language,
excuse me.
So tell me about your impression there. How does that layer fit?
So that's where kind of the rubber meets the road, or the theory becomes practicality. So as I have this repository where I can put models in it, if I keep that up to date, if I continually am looking for places where I can do this declarative modeling and put it in there, then I start to build up for my industry. Maybe accounts. Maybe it's, I'm drawing a blank on an industry example right now, but let's say I'm a bank and I've got things like accounts, I've got deposits, I've got transfers, I've got these different things that I might want to model. On top of that, I've got the security, I've got the auditing, I've got whatever regulatory things I need. Those have to be taken care of every single time I write an application. I can't today just decide, well, I'm going to ignore the federal government regulations and I'm just going to build what I want to build. If I can put those into the model so that the next time I go to build an application, I just pull them out of that modeling, I've got the code and it's been tested and it's there, then that makes my development so much easier. I can focus on whatever it is that I'm trying to solve today.
You know, that's a big deal. You know, what you said there reminded me of something probably 3-4 years ago. I was writing a proposal for a project that we never did, but when I was in Patterns and Practices, I was thinking about a project related to privacy. And as you know, privacy has become increasingly a bigger and bigger deal, a lot of regulatory issues there. And, you know, it hit me that privacy in an enterprise is so hit and miss, you know? I mean, you got one team that cares about it, maybe, and they're careful to encrypt things and not show things, and another team that doesn't know about it, and they, like, you know, I was shocked to watch this program the other night where these women were, you know, basically committing identity theft and using identities to open bogus credit cards and steal things. And it turned out all these women, the four of them, worked together in a hospital where they had access to the patient records, addresses, dates of birth, social security numbers, all that's necessary for identity theft. And, you know, because the hospital didn't have a way in their information system by policy to say, you know, this this information is highly confidential, it can't be seen by just any random person who gets a login here.
Right.
Then they're in big trouble. So, I mean, if you could attach, like, say, if I am going to store a Social Security number, if I could attach a policy to that and say, whenever this is used in any app, it has to comply these ways, and it's flagged for audits and all kinds of things, right?
Right. Yeah. And so I can envision where you would set that up in your model,
mm-hmm.
and you would have, you know, data layer or business objects or whatever that you would pull out of your model that would be aware of that. And so you're not getting that out of the box with Oslo.
Right.
Let's be clear, this is not, you know, going to solve all those problems. But if an organization wanted to take the time to build that in, they build it once and now they've got some place where they can just take a new developer, someone who's new to the company, or even experienced developers that may not have thought about these because they haven't worked in that area. I think a hospital is a great example. I might have been working on an inventory system to keep track of medicines and things like that and not even thought about Social Security numbers, and then suddenly they come along and say, we need you to work on our patient application. And now there's a whole bunch of different rules that I may not be aware of and may not be thinking of. If I could have the model and I'm just trained to go grab stuff out of the model and it's pre-coded, and this whole idea of object-oriented programming, of reusing the code, now it becomes a lot easier because I don't have to go over and call Bob or whoever wrote it and say, hey, you did something like that. Where is that at and how do I get to it?
Yeah.
I just have a place where I can go and find it.
Well, you can imagine because the repository is just very straightforward SQL. You consider the case where, like, one of the big hacking cases of our time, the TGX case,
right?
Where these guys hacked into the wireless network, start sniffing traffic, and they're able to obtain usernames and password credentials to get into the internal systems. They stole 45 million credit card
right.
numbers, okay? Huge, huge break-in. And you think about, well, now, if you could attach these policies to pieces of data, as you said, it's not out of the box in Oslo, but it lays the groundwork for you to do this.
Yes.
Then you could, when you think about what it takes to secure that, it means the code handles it securely, the database handles it securely, it's communicated securely on the wire. And so you've got code, you've got config, you've got database rules, and this spans departments and individuals. So, but you could, in essence, write an auditing tool that detects when this is being used in an app, could examine the config to say, hey, you know, they're using basic HTTP with no encryption. I don't care if it's on the internal network. You still can't
right.
do that.
Yes. Those scenarios are all enabled by this. And because, like you said, the repository is a SQL Server database, I really don't even have to, you know, fire up the application and get a protocol analyzer out and see if it's doing it. I can go look at the model and see what the model specifies.
Yeah.
I also can see going forward, again, not out of the box, and this is something that we kind of discussed with the product teams. There's no commitment on their part. But down the road, you could start modeling other things, the physical servers, the virtual machines, the network, the everything else. And much like we have with Visual Studio Team System Enterprise Edition and the models in there, you can start putting constraints. If I'm going to have this application, it has to run under SSL,
mm-hmm.
things like that. Right now, Visual Studio Team System has the ability to go look at the model, look at the constraints, and say, does this match? If I deploy this app onto this particular machine, will it run there in the environment it needs to be? I could see integrating all of that. And again, no commitment from the team on that, but in my ideal world, we would get to something like that where I could start modeling everything in my enterprise, and I could start then at design time even saying, will this work?
Mm-hmm.
As I drag things out of the repository and put them on the canvas, or as I use the model, I would get some sort of error that says, hey, wait a second, this doesn't match. The privacy policy is not being fulfilled here, or the security policy, or if you do this, there will be no way to audit it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this particular data, Social Security numbers, maybe we've got a policy that you can't use them on a mobile device because there's no way to secure that network. Or, you know, whatever that policy might be, I can see somewhere down the road, you know, 5, 10, hopefully not, you know, much more than that. But somewhere down the road, there would be this ability to just start doing this. And then that opens up, again, the developers. They don't have to think about that kind of stuff. They don't have to think about now, what was that in my email I got like 18 months ago about the new security policy? Let me go dig through that. It's just there for them.
But you know, the thing I think is going to be a big challenge out of this is, I mean, if you compare this to Link, let's say.
Yes, okay.
If you get an average developer and you show them Link, their eyes kind of light up and they go, whoa, that is way cool. You know, I love that. You know, I want to use that.
Right.
And then when you sit down with the average developer and say, you know, if you will do this more declaratively and work with this repository, then your enterprise will be able to audit these and compliance will be easier. And they'll be like, who cares about that?
Exactly. Taking back to the example I used earlier of a knowledge management system, I want to get data out. I don't necessarily want to be bothered with putting data in.
Yeah.
And that becomes an implementation detail, unfortunately. And I don't know how you change human nature other than hopefully people can look at this and see how much easier it is with a fully populated and useful repository mm-hmm. to do their development so that they look and say, wow, I want to do this. And you know, if we go back 10 or 15 years, object-oriented programming,
yeah.
it was much more difficult than doing procedural programming. We had the same problem then.
Oh,
how do
yeah.
you make people write objects when it's so much easier to just cobble together the spaghetti code?
Okay, picture this. 1992, I'm in Silicon Valley, uh-huh. and the company I'm working for says, we're switching to C++. They bring in an instructor. We got all the dev team into this this conference room where for 2 weeks they're teaching us day after day, you know, inheritance, polymorphism, encapsulation. I ate it up. I loved it. I thought it was great. I was a young developer, you know. And then I'm working with these crusty old guys, probably about my age now, right?
Yeah.
But they were you know, had been solid C guys for 20 years. You know, they hated it. They didn't want to do it. They thought it was stupid, you know, and they said it was slow. All those things. I'm sure it's the same battle over and again.
It's going to be the same battle. Any time you introduce something new, some people will want to change because they don't like what they're doing. Some people want to change because they see the vision, and I think the majority of people have to be convinced.
Yeah, and yeah. No, but I mean, there's a lot of people who looked at Windows workflow at some point in the past. They go, well, you know, I looked at that stuff. I don't know. It didn't. You know, it seemed kind of hard, and you know. This is a new workflow.
Yes, there's been significant improvements in the workflow. I think it's easier to use and easier to understand. And the fact that now we can integrate it with that repository helps us a lot, too, so that we're not doing maybe so much of the tedious stuff. If there are separate steps and things like that, we can kind of put them in as part of our model in the repository instead of having to build that out each time.
So I think one of the things going to be kind of interesting to figure out is, you know, we're not saying people are not going to write code anymore.
Oh, no, definitely. Yeah. There's still...
you got to write code.
Yeah. No programmers should lose their jobs over this, let's be clear.
Yeah.
There's still enough code out there and enough problems that need to be solved that we're not... We're making improvements, you know, evolutionary, revolutionary, that's still to be debated.
Yeah.
I see it more as a kind of a larger evolution. But yes, the things that we've done before are still supported, and we'll still be able to write code, and we'll be able to drop into code for those places in the workflow where we have activities or other things that we need to do. We're not quite to the point where the, you know, receptionist at the front desk will be writing applications.
God help us if that ever happens.
Yeah.
You know, I think of it this way, is that, you know, if you look at a well-factored program, you find a lot of highly granular components that are very disciplined. They do one thing or do it really well or whatever. And then you find other pieces of code that kind of are coordinating. You know, it's like create one of those, call that thing, take that and put it over here and do this until you're done, and then that's the end.
Right.
So I think that piece of code is a good candidate for a workflow. And these other things, yeah, you're still going to write code, and to make them accessible in the workflow world, they're probably an activity that you can bring in there.
Exactly. And I think that's very good guidance, and then it just becomes a matter of trying to figure out how far down do we go. I mean, mm-hmm. you could take it to the extreme where every program you write, if there's an if statement in there, that's a branch in a workflow.
Yeah,
I don't
yeah.
think that's very effective. It certainly is not efficient. So.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to go down to that level, but, you know, it's striking that balance.
Well, I think you have to ask, you know, what's the difference between just this code and this workflow, if both of them call the same set of objects. And I think in the world of Oslo and the repository and all that, the workflow is visible, understandable, can be modeled. The code is opaque. We don't know what it does.
Right.
Right. So there's some value in making it visible to the repository.
Exactly. And I think in a well-architected system, the code pieces, those opaque pieces, are things that, for the most part, should be things that don't change. And, you know, if you think about retail and how it's changed, you know, it used to be the corner shop and then to larger shops and then to chains and then to kind of the bricks and mortar, and now as more moves online, you could make a case for retail has changed. But really, some of the core fundamentals about product placement and, you know, sales and just the things that retail does, those probably haven't changed and probably won't change. And so those are the kind of things that you might want to have as core pieces of functionality, those opaque pieces. And then the other stuff that glues them together and how we do things, if that's workflow, then if someone comes up with a new model for retail, I have no idea what that might be, but if I could just change the workflow around it, maybe add a few new things to support this new model, but the core stuff that stays the same,
mm-hmm.
I have to produce the product or deliver the product somehow, and I have to get money for it. That's not changing.
Sure.
Those make perfect sense to be in code and opaque, because a business person doesn't really need to know the details of how I go out and validate a credit card or, you know, what happens if a return check happens or whatever. They just need to know that there's a process to handle it.
They just want to see on that workflow, you know, validate the credit card, you know.
Get the money.
Do this, do that. You know, and then you have the business rules. And so this is the place where very often is the intersection they need to play in, you know. And so they come to you and say, we used to say you had 30 days to pay. Now we're going to change that to 15, you know. And so if it's all in opaque code, you got a lot of hunting down, find all that stuff. But if it's
exactly.
in business rules, it's a lot better.
Yeah, the business rules and in the workflow, or, you know, because you could put it in a workflow or something with a trigger or a database rule even.
Mm-hmm.
The rules engine, the BizTalk server has a business rules engine. People have been writing their own rules engines for a long time, and that's a perfect place to put that kind of information.
Sure, sure.
Stuff that will change, making it more visible to the business. A lot of times, too, that's this kind of stuff that gets set and then forgotten about.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so 3 years later, people are saying, how come these guys are still paying net 30? We set net 15 on the bottom of the invoice. Why aren't we charging them the late fee? And it's because nobody thought about it.
Or, you know, maybe they couldn't find it.
Or they couldn't find it, yeah.
Okay, so one last thing, though, is we're thinking strategically here. I mean, there's this whole, you know, software and the cloud, software and services. Where do you see this going for the enterprise? Do you think people are going to say, yeah, put my workflow in the cloud, put my services in the cloud? Do you think that'll happen?
Yeah, I think there's a subset mm-hmm. of workflows that it makes perfect sense to put in the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you think about what makes a company strategic and differentiates them from their competitors, it's probably not their inventory system or their, you know, even to some extent the CRM or things like that, because those are commodity objects that are customized. So those kind of things maybe make sense in the cloud, some sort of utility computing. I think Salesforce.com has been very successful at that
mm-hmm.
because the way that people do sales changes a little bit, but for the most part, if you can give them an 80% solution, people don't have to take on the cost and the effort to maintain their own stuff. They look at that and say, well, in the give and take, I can give up this a little bit of functionality that I would really like to have for this cost savings of not having to build out the hardware and the software and keep people around. So I think some of that stuff will move to the cloud. Other things that make you very different from your competitors, the things that give you the competitive advantage, I think will probably stay in-house until it becomes a commodity.
Well, but you know what, though? I think there's a, more and more today, our business relationships span organizations that are partners or working together somehow. And, you know, it seems like the friction there is the connection points between the organizations,
yes.
You know, opening the firewalls and all this kind of stuff. Maybe working through the cloud simplifies that. I'll give you a perfect example. I was at the doctor the other day, and, you know, I need to get a prescription. And I've been doing this for years, right? You go to the doctor, they write the little prescription to give you, then you got to go to the pharmacy, and then you got to wait for them to do it, and then you go home, right?
Right.
For the first time ever, I can't believe my doctor had this, right? He goes, what pharmacy do you want? And I said, the pharmacy. He goes, I'll just send this right over to them. It just went. And then, like, by the time I got there, it was ready for me. That was totally awesome. Okay, yes. Not that I'm shopping for a doctor, but if I was, you know, that would be a very strong selling point for them, because they eliminated the friction out of my life by interacting with a partner better that way.
Exactly. Yeah, and so I think that's one place where that doctor has differentiated themselves from another doctor. So I would imagine that those kind of services would start in-house. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's a differentiator until it becomes a commodity.
Yeah.
As soon as the rest of the doctors in the area realize that, hey, our patients want that,
yeah,
then they're going to figure out a way, whoever they purchased their software to run their office from, they're going to go to them and demand that they add that functionality to that software. And then it becomes somewhat of a commodity. And then it makes perfect sense to move it into the cloud, where mm-hmm. I don't have to maintain it, where there's backup, where there's all sorts of other things. But it's a really hard thing to look at and say, should I move this or not?
Yeah.
I mean, even some things like an inventory system that you might say, well, that's pretty commodity. You look at Walmart, and they've been very successful because they track and they understand and they mine that data. That's something that I would assume they're not even thinking about moving to the cloud. I have no idea, but, you know, if it's that important, if someone offers that system and can give me those reports,
yeah,
they can give my competitor those same reports
as
well.
But you know what, though, I think is the big differentiator there is I think the cloud is going to be good at leveling the playing field. You know,
yes.
The big Walmart guy, sure, they're going to have their own data center. They got staff upon staff to, like, huge database and all that
right.
stuff. But the little guy who's just coming up, but he wants to do similar things, and if he can acquire that in the cloud, just the service, without all the cost and baggage that goes with it, it's way better.
It's way better, and that's the kind of thing that, you know, website analytics or, you know, sales patterns or any of this data mining that your normal mom and pop store, you know, they don't know databases, they don't know how to create a cube, they don't know how to mine that cube. But if I could take that data and put it into the cloud and then click the button that says, show me what my top selling mm-hmm. items are, show me the correlation between putting this item as a featured item on my website and the sales, show me this kind of information, and they can start making those decisions that will help them to grow their business. That's where I see the real power in the cloud, where someone can provide that information, and because they can scale out to a lot of these different shops, it makes sense for them to do it and offer it as a service and then charge a small monthly fee. Other things like backup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm a small shop and I really don't have an IT department, and what's worse, if I'm running it out of my house, what do I do about offsite backup?
Yeah.
You know, talk to my neighbor next door and say, can I start storing some tapes in your basement? You know.
So and in fact, that's a huge one that has taken off. I mean,
yes.
I know a lot of people, non-technical people, and they're not backing up, you know, super critical things, but like the family photos or whatever,
yes,
right?
Yes.
I mean, why not? It works. It's transparent. You can count on it. I think that's super.
There's a lot of those kinds of scenarios, and the hard part is for each business to decide, does this have enough value to me that I'm willing to pay for it in-house, or is there someone who can provide it better, cheaper out in the cloud?
Yeah.
And that, I think, is going to take a little while to shake out, and I see more things moving to the cloud as we get more used to this paradigm and we get over some of our fears about maybe, you know, the network going down or privacy or whatever else. But, you know, it's going to be an interesting ride.
Very interesting ride. Big changes in the cloud. For Endpoint TV, I'm your host, Ron Jacobs.